Greetings. You are listening to the Northeast Ohio AFSC Weekly Audio Podcast. I'm Greg Coleridge. It is Friday, October 16th. I hope you are well. And as we say every week, we hope this podcast informs you about issues you feel are important, but not hearing elsewhere, updates you about past and upcoming AFSC plans and activities, and inspires you to take action. It is, after all, grassroots social movements made up of well-informed, prepared, and motivated people that create real change. We begin, as we do every week, with a report of our activities from this last week. This past Monday evening, I gave a talk at the University of Akron in the School of Social Work to a class on social policy analysis to students, actually, who were both in the presence physically of the University of Akron, as well as teleconferenced a number of students in the same class, but in a different physical location at Cleveland State. I wanted to hear about AFSC, the work we do, both in terms of education, advocacy, organizing, and how one converts an idea into policy. They are in the midst of a major assignment in trying to create or promote a specific law and wanted to know how that happens. So that was a fruitful discussion, hopefully from their end anyway. It seemed like it from my end. Wednesday, I gave a presentation to the monthly meeting of delegates of the North Shore Federation of Labor, the name of the, you could say, Cleveland AFL-CIO, to provide an update of the Cleveland Move to Amend petition campaign. I'd previously spoken to that group in referencing that there was going to be a campaign, but this was the first time to actually announce it and talk about it and try to recruit individuals to participate in the effort to either get more information, get a petition themselves, have a speaker make a presentation to their local, if not for the entire North Shore Federation of Labor at some point, to endorse the effort. Of course, the goal of the Cleveland campaign is to, in Cleveland anyway, to get on the ballot is required 6,000 valid signatures, and that's needed by next July. So it was received pretty well. About a dozen people signed up to get more info, petition, and or have someone come in and speak. And that's a good start. And a couple of individuals have some other ideas on how to spread the message even wider. Also on Wednesday evening was the gathering of the monthly monetary literacy group. This is an organization ad hoc that meets pretty diverse politically, very much focused on issues around using monetary policy as a public tool and take it out of the hands of banking corporations where it now exclusively, for the most part, lies. That being monetary policy is the power to create and distribute money is first and foremost. That power is a pretty important one when it comes to economic development, when it comes to social economic well-being, and when it comes to protecting, expanding self-governance. When those decisions about who's going to create money and how it's going to be distributed is left exclusively, for the most part, in private hands, well, then we the people don't have much of a determination as to where those dollars are going to go, who it's going to benefit, and who it's going to buy not going to certain areas or to certain people harm. Anyway, the subject matter for our gathering this past Wednesday was basically entitled, the theme was Quantitative Easing for the People, a discussion of creating and directly distributing money to the public, which is now arisen in past, actually going back maybe a year ago, when the organization, the magazine Foreign Affairs Journal, which is a pretty exclusive magazine and publication of sort of top-down political, military, economic elites in our country, published a piece on how and maybe why money should in fact be distributed directly, not through surrogate middle entities like banks, which have not loaned out funds sufficiently to individuals, whether it's individual people or individual small businesses, but has kept most of those trillions of dollars sort of in-house, lending it to, by the Federal Reserve anyway, lending it to their member banks or to companies to buy back stock, but it's not trickled down at all into the larger economy. So realizing that there may be some major disenchantment in the not-too-distant future, to put it mildly, public opposition that may come together, organize, take to the streets, demand substantive change. The powers to be may be trying to get out ahead of the curve and suggest, well, maybe at least for in this little way, we should be putting a significant amount of money directly in the hands of the public because, well, when you think about it economically, businesses are not going to expand production if they are not sure that there's going to be a demand for their products or services. I mean, that's what bottom-up economics is all about. That's really how the economy works, not in theory, but in practice. So one way to do that, if that's not being done through the conventional market, which has been horrifically distorted through monetary policies, zero interest rates, and quantitative easing for the banksters and for the one percenters, then maybe we need to intervene in this kind of way. And this is coming from the realms of not just foreign affairs, but The Economist magazine had a piece recently about the same thing. Something along these lines already exists, as our readings showed, in the underdeveloped, so-called underdeveloped world, with instead of having agencies try to supply and help people out of poverty in Africa and in other countries, why not just put money directly in the hands of people, either with or without certain conditions? Conditions being, for example, that their kids have to go to school mandatorily. And oftentimes those dollars that end up going with no conditions or minimal conditions end up going to people who start their own businesses and are able to supply themselves and become self-sustaining and independent off of any or very minimal external charity. Anyway, those were the subjects, the topics, the articles we talked about we have learn something about as we continue on this quest to understand basically how money should be used for us and not against us. Thursday, this past week, two events that went on that AFSC had a role in. More specifically, the main role was a ongoing study series that AFSC, along with the Akron Organizing Collaborative and The Womb, which stands for Way of Mind and Body, in Akron co-sponsored on what is called Creating Social Change, a study series on racism, oppression, and self-determination. It's a nine-part series. We are in session five, though they are independent and separate enough that by no means is it important or essential that people have to go through the previous ones to participate in the present one. Certainly helpful, but certainly not at all mandatory. The gathering this past yesterday on the 15th that we focused on was about the labor movement. Fascinating couple of videos we saw in the two-hour session, as well as reflections on a reading out of the book, maybe the very best labor history book anyway that I've run into, called Labor's Untold Story, written a number of years ago, 20, 25 years ago, by the United Electrical Workers. Read the first chapter of that, as well as a couple of articles about the Lawrence strike up in Massachusetts and just what conditions were like for working people at the turn of the last century. Reflected, as the reading did, on the importance, very importance, an inextricable connection between the liberation of people of color, in particular African Americans, following and leading up to, but certainly immediately following the Civil War, and the plight and success or lack thereof of the labor movement. To the extent that people of color are not treated equally and fairly, and are oppressed well, that's going to bring down not just them, but non-people of color, and in particular, historically, that has happened with people who try in the labor movement to come together and unify themselves for better wages, better working conditions. When a certain segment of the population are treated as second or third class citizens, well, they can be used as scabs, as those who drive down the wages or the threat of higher wages within the labor movement. And many historically within the labor movement understood these connections and worked simultaneously for labor rights as well as the rights of people of color, while others did not. So those are some of the issues that we kind of grappled with and tried to learn some lessons from, not just historically learning lessons from the past, but what that means today in this era of immigration where, again, many people who are coming into this country, as well as many people who have resided in their country, in this country, and their ancestors, namely people of color, are still, when it comes to economic conditions, treated as second-class citizens, where their salaries, their working conditions are still not equal to those of whites. And certainly among immigrants, it is as bad, if not in some cases even worse. So it's not just sort of a historical discussion going on, but one that is very relevant to the present. Next month, the theme subject is the civil rights movement, where we will again be talking about what happened in the past, but as those conditions happened, how they are relevant, to what extent are some of the lessons that took place and learned in the past applicable or not to the present. So that is, we'll be announcing the dates for that next month, but it is, I believe, on the 19th of November. Again, that will be in Akron at the Womb, 915 East Market Street. And there'll be a notice of what those specific readings are. You can check our website, check our Facebook page. We'll probably have those up in a week or so. Also yesterday was the meeting, monthly meeting of the Cleveland Move to Amend Action Planning Gathering. It took place at the Martin Luther King Jr. Library on Stokes Boulevard. A committee person of AFSC attended that meeting to support that effort to secure, as previously mentioned, 6,000 valid signatures needed by next July to get a Move to Amend initiative on the ballot in the city of Cleveland. We realize that as the weather starts turning not quite as conducive for being out of doors, that the challenge to secure signatures is even going to become more challenging. Toward that end, there's a big effort, at least over the next couple of months, to focus on a couple of specific dates where we're trying to get maximum participation by anyone. Don't have to live in Cleveland. If you're anywhere near Cleveland, want to help the cause, just for a couple of hours, there's going to be a major effort to try to get people out on election day in Cleveland, where everyone who goes to the polls, obviously, is a registered voter. And so even though it is an off-year election, won't be as many people turning out. If you can help on Tuesday, November 3rd, in petitioning just for an hour, either first in the morning as people go out before work or over lunch or after work, any of those times are the peak times, relatively speaking, when people will turn out. Probably the best time would be either early in the morning or after work. Probably after work, maybe the single best time. So if you can lend an hour, 90 minutes, 2 hours, any amount of time, call our office, 330-928-2301, and we can get you a petition and give you a place to go. If petitioning is not your thing, that's all right. You can help by making a few phone calls. We have a phone tree. The Cleveland Move to Amend group, that is, has set up a phone tree to help mobilize Move to Amend Cleveland area members and participants. So, again, if interested in that, maybe give Lois Romanoff, who's one of the co-conveners of Move to Amend, a call. She can set you up with names. Her and numbers. Her number is 216-231-2170. That's Lois Romanoff, 216-231-2170. If she's not available, Chris Stocking, the other sort of co-convener, he can be reached 440-376-8400. That's Chris at 440-376-8400. And actually, either Chris or Lois could also give you a polling place and get you a petition. So If you want to make one-stop shopping, call one or the other, and they could line you up with one or both of those things. So that was a brief summary of events this past week. Pretty busy. No less busy, though, than what's coming up this next week. Tomorrow, the 17th, from 11 to 3 p.m., is a very interesting gathering being planned. Forum called The Rise of the Labor Movement in Ohio, Populism, Socialism, and the Campaign to Amend the 1912 Ohio State Constitution. A mouthful, to be sure, but nevertheless very descriptive of what is going to take place at Max Hayes High School, 2211 West 65th Street in Cleveland. The program is in honor of Max Hayes, a recognized 20th century champion of labor, democracy, and social welfare. The group Labor Education and Arts Project in Cleveland is sponsoring a commemoration in his memory that's going to be held tomorrow, and it coincides with the reopening of Max Hayes High School, which was the school is being reopened in a brand new location. Well, it's a new school anyway, so it's a very new school. Again, the address is 2211 West 65th Street, and the event itself is to commemorate this legendary founder and editor of what became America's oldest labor newspaper, the Cleveland Citizen, with the mission to advance the cause of a politically active, aggressive labor movement. The Citizen was in the forefront of a statewide campaign to amend the 1912 Ohio State Constitution. That campaign proposed that Ohio voters consider 42 labor-endorsed issues for amendment to the Constitution, including women's suffrage, child labor laws, workmen's compensation, the 8-hour workday, abolition of the word white only, recall of elected officials, and the direct democracy of the initiative and referendum. 34 of the 42 proposed amendments were ratified by Ohio voters and incorporated into the Constitution as a result of that 1912 Constitutional Convention and the amendments to the 1912 State Constitution. So there will be a number of speakers, including Professor Michael Pierce, author of Striking with the Ballot, Ohio Labor and the Populist Party, Mary Treese, who is a professor of communications at the University of Akron, who has specialized in women and labor, Stephen Steinglass, Dean Emeritus of the Cleveland Marshall College of Law, and David Goldberg, Professor Emeritus at Cleveland State University. Following a luncheon, the legacy of the 1912 campaign to expand and strengthen democracy here in Ohio will be reconsidered for present-day political strategy. Toward that end, proponents will address the assembly in behalf of such issues as increasing the minimum wage, Medicare for all, union recognition for adjunct faculty, efforts against mass incarceration, abolition of capital punishment, and electoral finance reform. It is free. The public is invited. I will be one of the possibly one of the luncheon speakers commenting on issue 2, which is an effort to thwart the democratic citizen initiative process that was created under the 1912 Constitutional Convention, and or panelists in the afternoon commenting on this, as well as prospects of amending the Ohio Constitution in support of public financing of elections and or move to amend. So all of that is taking place tomorrow from 11 to 3 at Max Hayes High School, again, address 2211 West 65th. On Monday, there is a meeting open to the public, anti-poverty economic justice planning to coincide with the Republican National Convention. A number of groups led by Organize Ohio are coming together to plan to do a major march and rally around the themes of anti-poverty and economic justice during the what will probably be the first day of the RNC next July, which would be July 18th, probably in the afternoon. Plans toward those ends are going to be ongoing, have been taking place, next meeting of which is Monday, 1 p.m. at the Green Building, 3500 Lorraine Avenue. Thursday, there will be a showing in Shaker Heights of the film Legalize Democracy, sponsored by the Shaker Heights Move to Amend group as part of their ongoing effort to secure enough signatures to get their Move to Amend initiative on the ballot next November in Shaker Heights. The event is at 7 p.m. Again, it's Thursday, the 22nd. It's in the main library, room E on the second floor. That main library is located at 16500 Van Aken Boulevard. The film will be shown. There'll be some discussion. I'll be providing some comments and answering questions, but mostly it is the Shaker Heights Move to Amends event that will be focused a lot on what has already taken place and what needs to continue to occur over the next couple of months. I think the goal is to try to come up with enough signatures maybe by the end of the year so people don't have to be out in January, February, or March securing signatures so that next year, 2016, right up to November, can be focused on doing education about these issues of corporate personhood, money is speech, how insane they are, anti-democratic they are, making it unable for we the people to have our voices heard, our communities helped, our needs met. So all of that will be taking place next Thursday, the 22nd at 7 p.m. Well, we comment now very briefly on several issues from this past week that AFSC here and elsewhere addresses. A couple in particular. The first is has to do with the ongoing conflict, violence, and injustice in many places of the Middle East. There's two numerous places and countries to mention, so we're just going to comment on three places: Syria, Afghanistan, and Israel-Palestine. In Afghanistan, this past week, yesterday, I guess it was, President Obama announced that there will be no drawdown of U.S. troops in that country through the end of his term, after 14 years of fighting. The bombs, bullets, and billions of dollars, that is, not to mention troops, bases, and an ongoing occupation, haven't worked, yet the solution is more of the same. Well, the root of the problem isn't military. It never has been. Yet this continues to be sort of the perpetual solution over serious attention to political, economic, religious, and other social concerns. The U.S. strategy has horribly failed and will continue to do so if we look at every problem and only look through every problem, primarily anyway, through the scope of a gun on a soldier's soldier or that on a tank or in a plane. In Afghanistan, it was reported yesterday that the tragic bombing of the Doctors Without Borders hospital has taken a new turn. The Associated Press is now reporting, as reported yesterday, that the ground troops in the area, the ones who apparently called in the airstrike, knew it was a hospital. Additionally, it's reported that the Pentagon had actually ordered the troops on the ground to conduct surveillance against the hospital on suspicion that a Pakistan intelligence spy was inside. Officials were even privately saying, according to the AP article, that the attack on the protected hospital full of civilians was justified because of this. Well, if this is true, then there is no question that the U.S. engaged in a war crime. The U.S. has rejected calls for an independent investigation. Instead, yesterday, apparently, U.S. soldiers were sent to the site to smash up the bombed hospital with a tank, destroying potential evidence for the internal U.S. investigation. Both of these conditions are horrific. Please consider calling Congress. The Congressional Switchboard number, 202-224-3124, voice your views, your opposition toward U.S. continued occupation and an ongoing quagmire in Afghanistan. The longer we're there, the sorts of accidents, quote-unquote, or intentional deliberate attacks that are ongoing that result in death to civilian, more than any, is the pain and horror that results to civilians and the destruction of communities. That's been the major drawback, the major harms, the major victims have been the civilian citizens and residents who are in Afghanistan. Call Congress, let them know U.S. needs to get out of Afghanistan, there needs to be a serious, legitimate, independent investigation of what occurred at the Doctors Without Borders Hospital. Again, that number, 202-224-3121. In Syria, since 2011, the second of the three countries we want to say something about in the Middle East, there have been more than 10 million Syrians that have fled their homes to escape violence and insecurity. The latest wave of refugees are moving into and have moved into southern and central Europe is causing horrific misery, obviously, to those fleeing. Nobody wants to leave their country, and putting incredible strains on neighboring nations. Again, you are encouraged to call Congress to support the Syrian refugees and to call for an end to the war in Syria. 202-224-3121 is the number to the Congressional Switchboard. And the three things or a couple of things to ask of your congressperson, your senators, are these. One is to support a comprehensive arms embargo, including stopping the flow of weapons from countries neighboring Syria and halting training and technical assistance to all armed groups involved in the conflict. Second is to call on international and regional powers to organize multilateral negotiations to achieve a ceasefire and end the conflict. Third is to increase the number of refugees resettled in the U.S. Next year, beginning actually to the current fiscal year we're in, beginning this past October 1st, to 200,000 from 100,000, so basically doubling it, reserved for Syrian refugees. And lastly, to call on Congress to do what they can to increase humanitarian assistance, particularly to host countries neighboring Syria. These four demands are those that our national American Friends Service Committee, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1947, is calling on Congress to take immediate action on. You are invited to do the same. Again, call Congress, 202-224-3121. Lastly, in Israel, my colleague with AFSC, Jennifer Bing, who is in Chicago, who is also quite a Middle East expert, having spent the better part of 3 decades studying, writing, visiting, living in the Middle East, has written recently a compelling piece about visiting an Israeli military prison that houses children in the West Bank. Israeli military law allows potential maximum sentences, for example, of up to 20 years for a charge of simply throwing stones. And this applies not only to adults, but also potentially to young people. If you go to the main page of AFSC, that's afsc.org, you can find a link and you can click on the link to the full article. So that's what currently is going on. That's current existing Israeli military law that is punishing people in general, but is seemingly disproportionately hurting, and the conditions in the West Bank are causing incredible suffering to people in general, but in particular disproportionately affecting young people. On the military aid front, the U.S. is considering giving Israel another $45 billion in new military aid over the next 10 years. The aid will encourage regional arms races, which sustain regional conflicts and instability. So please contact on both of these fronts your congressperson, as well as your senators. Senators in Ohio happen to be Senator Sherrod Brown and Rob Portman, opposing such military aid and opposing and calling on Israel by Congress to halt the harsh treatment of children by Israel on the West Bank. All right, turning away from those deplorable conditions and what needs to be done in the Middle East to a couple of other issues and articles that have appeared worth commenting on and acting on here from this past week. An interesting article appeared documenting. This was a document called the Global Wealth Report 2015, issued by the financial firm Credit Suisse out of, I think it's Switzerland. And this report that they issue annually shows that the world's wealthiest 1%, top 1% in the world, now owns more assets than the Earth's bottom 99% combined. Now, this fact occurs simultaneously to 30,000 children that die daily from preventable poverty, despite, since 1969, the 1% and above wealth and political leaders of so-called developed and former colonial powers having promised to, quote, end poverty once and for all, forever. The total poverty deaths just since 1995 alone are about 400 million people, more than all the wars and all the violent deaths in recorded human history. Please take a moment to experience that death from poverty. It's just incredibly gruesomely slow and painful, both for the victims and all who love them. We need to stop this. Now, obviously, we can't do anything about what's taking place in many other parts of the world, but we certainly can address the incredible and growing widening of wealth between the top 1% and the bottom 99% here at home, through spending policies, through tax policies, through monetary policies. And this is yet another reason and cause for contacting Congress, or to, when you run into them in person the next time they're in your part of the world, to just continue to raise up the issue of growing gap between rich and poor. It's not just an intellectual issue, but it is literally an issue of life and death. This week, turning to a third topic, Time magazine reports that government corruption now tops the list of Americans' top fears. Corruption of government officials is currently Americans' number one fear, according to a recent survey by researchers as reported in Time magazine at Chapman University. The researchers asked a random sampling of over 1,500 adults to rate the level of fear for 88 different fear options across a wide variety of domains, like crime and natural disasters. Based on their findings, here are the top 10. Government corruption of government officials at 58%, cyber terrorism 44.8%, corporate tracking of personal information 44.6%, terrorist attacks 44.4%, government tracking of personal information 44.1%, biowarfare 40.9%, identity theft 39.6%, economic collapse 39.2%. I think that will be rising here in the next year, if not before. Running out of money in the future, that one will be rising as well, given the declining and deteriorating economic conditions. That's at 37.4%. Credit card fraud at 36.9%. Last month, Gallup poll found that 75% of Americans said they believe corruption is widespread in the government. That was up from 66% in 2009. Of course, a good deal of government corruption is linked to government officials and the government itself being hijacked by corporations and the super-duper rich, which is connected to the issues that we focus on quite a bit, that of trying to end corporate personhood and money is speech. Both the corporate crowd and the incredibly well-to-do have stolen our government, have hijacked it, and are using it day in and day out for their own benefit. So, of course, government officials are going to be corrupted to benefit a few, namely them, at the expense of most of the rest of us. Not to say that without these things there would not be inherently corruption to some extent. Of course there would. But a tremendously large percentage of it. Impossible to prove to what percent, but given the increasing ability of corporations and of the well-to-do to manipulate, distort, and maneuver government, laws, regulations for their own ends, of course, that is another way of describing what government corruption is all about. Which is why, if you haven't already become involved in where you are, past, present, or future, in the Move to Amend campaign, we invite you to do so. This is the ultimate way to address a big piece, not the only, not all, but a big piece of what is being described and defined, no doubt, by those 1,500 adults who were sampled, government corruption. Lastly, a New York Times piece reported this past week related to money in politics, that of the 120 million families in the United States, 120 million families, only 158 have provided collectively more than 50% of the funding to presidential candidates in the 2016 cycle up to this present time. They've contributed or invested, depending on how you want to look at it, these 158 families, $176 million. They are, if you sort of look at the numbers to see who they are overwhelmingly white, older, well-to-do, and, of course, headed up by males. In a nation that is being, every day, becoming younger, with more women and more black and brown voters. And in an economy that has minted billionaires in a dizzying array of industries, the New York Times says, most of their fortunes of these 158 families come from just two industries, energy and finance, meaning the fossil fuel industry that is doing its very best to delay as long as possible any serious conversion of funds away from subsidizing massively, which occurs now through taxes and spending and the like, the fossil fuel industry, the dinosaur industry, to renewable industry. So that's the one category, the one industry. And the other is finance. FIRE industry, what's called finance, real estate, and what is FIRE? FIRE, insurance and real estate. So it's the bankers, the real estate industry, insurance industry, collectively is giving, because again, they are benefiting tremendously from the bailouts, from the quantitative easing, from the protection of being prosecuted, which of course has, for the most part, not happened. So those are the entities right now that are doing their very best, those 158 families, to insulate themselves, to make sure that they invest in the public officials, the candidates anyway, who want to be the top public official in this country, so that whoever wins, they will be protected and themselves, in their own way, insured. Well, that's all for this week. Keep up with our activities. Contact us with questions, concerns, or willingness to help out. Our website is, please visit afsc.org/Akron, Facebook page. Please like us, facebook.com/NEOAFSC. Our program blog, northeastohioafsc.wordpress.com. My blog, createrealdemocracy.wordpress.com. Until next week, onward for justice, peace, and democracy.